My name is Paul Fine. I'm the director of the film. I want to thank you all for coming out tonight, and I wanted to thank you, more importantly, for your interest in drug policy. Last night, I had a dream. I had a dream I was at a cocktail party with Barack Obama, and I got him into the corner of the room, and I said, "Mr. President, you know, what are you going to do about drug reform in your second term?" And he said, "You know what? I care a lot about drug policy reform. I've always been passionate about it, but there are bigger fish to fry. We've got problems in Syria, we've got a healthcare debate, we have budget problems at home." And then he started to tell a story, and I was thinking to myself, you know, I wanted to tell him, you could really add to your legacy if you were to make some changes right now. And at that point, the alarm went off in my hotel room, the alarm that had been set by the previous occupant of the room. And so I didn't get to continue the conversation with President Obama, but I'm very pleased that we're able to continue this conversation here tonight and going into the future. And so right now, I'd like to introduce, we have John Tierney of the New York Times. Excuse me.
Thank you.
Melissa Mark Bibierto, she's a New York City Council member. Ethan Nadelman. Ethan Nadelman of the Drug Policy Alliance. And finally, Mary O'Grady of the Wall Street Journal. I'm going to ask each of the panelists to talk just for a few minutes to give their perspective on the current drug prohibition debate, and then we'll open it up for some questions and answers. Mary, would you like to start?
Sure. Okay. My instructions from the moderator are that I have 5 minutes to tell you all of my views on the war on drugs, which is quite brief. So I just decided to break it down into three things. I write for the Wall Street Journal. I write a column, a weekly column called The Americas, which is about the Americas outside of the United States. So most of the focus is on Latin America, a little bit of Canada. And so the first point I want to make is just that in 20 years of doing this job, the cost of the current drug policy has been really my issue. I know that there's a lot of conversation about how the drug policy affects Americans living in this country, but the cost to developing countries of our war on drugs has been extremely high and debilitating, not just for individuals who get caught in the crossfire, but also for the broader ability of these countries to develop. Latin American presidents have talked to me about the way that the organized crime networks, which get so much money from the cartels, are able to overwhelm these very frail states. And as we know from the work of the economist Douglas North, who won the Nobel Prize, institutions are very important for development. And if you don't have strong, independent institutions, it's very hard to get over a lot of the problems associated with being a poor country. And really, institutional development has been greatly hampered by the fact that these organized criminal networks use the money they have to corrupt the institutions and weaken the ability of those institutions to basically defend the rule of law. The second point I want to make is just about the failure, and obviously you just saw this film, so you know all about the failure, but I was struck just overnight, I think it was yesterday, the news that came from France about the drug bust of 1.3 tons of cocaine that were found in a plane going from Venezuela to France. And it reminded me that some of you may know that former Secretary of State George Shultz is also against the current policy of our current drug policy. And he likes to tell the story of being with former Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan way back when, I think it was in the 70s, and he was in a car going out to Camp David with the senator, and the senator said to him, "Hey, great news. We busted the French connection." And George Shultz said, you know, he just kept doing his work in the limo and he didn't really answer. And Moynihan was like, "No, don't you see? We busted the French connection." And he didn't answer him. And finally, Moynihan said to him, I bet you're one of those people who think that as long as we have strong demand for drugs in this country, we're not going to be able to win the war on drugs. And George Shultz claims that he looked at him and said, Moynihan, there's hope for you yet. And when I heard about this drug bust yesterday, I thought, you know, did Daniel Patrick Moynihan ever imagine that so many years later we would still be, you know, chasing drugs around the jungles, the Andean jungles, and making these size drug busts? Am I running out of time? I have one more point to make. And that is, then I asked myself, looking at the high cost and the obvious failure to achieve anything, why doesn't it change? And on that, I just want to make two points. One, obviously, there's a lot of interests. I mean, there are a lot of people who make money off of chasing drug people around the jungle and trying to defoliate the South American continent. But the second thing is, I think that there's a lot of fear on the part of people who are against this. And this is where I think, you know, those of us who are in favor of changing the policy have to try to empathize with those, the legitimate fear that people have that, one, there'll be a spike in use, and two, that the costs will be shifted onto, you know, them. In other words, people will start using drugs more, and then there'll be a higher healthcare cost, and that cost will land on people who are not involved with it at all. And so that moral hazard, I think, is also a big concern on the part of people who oppose a change in policy. And lastly, let me just say that I think when we're trying to market this idea, we should admit that it's not a panacea, that there will be problems from it. What we have to try to communicate is that there are costs and benefits to any policy, and right now the costs way outweigh the benefits, and we should try to find something where the costs are lower and that they and where those costs land on those people who are engaged in that activity, not on innocent people, and where the benefits are higher. And that's I'll finish there. Thank you.
Thanks. And Melissa, would you like to go next?
Marguerite. No, go ahead.
Okay. Well, good evening, everybody. And I think I feel kind of a little bit out of place on this panel, but I think that I really want to commend the film. You know, I think it really obviously puts a lot of information out there. And as you're watching it, it was very heartbreaking, but also very overwhelming, right? Sometimes it feels like it's an insurmountable issue to tackle. But then looking, you know, in terms of really at the end of the film and looking at it from the perspective of what can we do, you know, at a very local level, I think is the way to begin, right? And I'm a New York City legislator, so my focus is very much in terms of local law and legislation and things, policies that we can enact to be more effective and to be more just. And when we look at the conversation that has ensued in this mayoral debate around stop and frisk, a subset of the issue that we're dealing with is marijuana arrests. We're here in New York City, we have over 50,000 marijuana arrests happening a year. And in a district like the one that I represent, which is overwhelmingly of color, it is low income. Within the district that I represent of East Harlem in the South Bronx, I have two police precincts that have the highest stop and frisks in the respective boroughs. So, you know, the issue is very real to my constituents. It's an issue that we deal with every day. And the inefficiency of a policy that is criminalizing our young people, that is wasting our resources in ways, as the film talks about, that could be better spent on strategies that we know work. Taking examples of other countries and other municipalities, things that have worked and strategies that have worked. And we really have a hard time, I think, in this country on accepting that we have things to learn from other places. And so from a very local perspective, you know, knowing when we discuss the city budget every year that about $75 million is being wasted in the amount of time that police officers are going after such a low-level offense and the implications that that has, not only financially, but socially within our communities, right? Where now you have a young person, primarily because these are young people of color, African-American and Latinos, that now are going through a system, sometimes are 24 hours for, again, a marijuana arrest. You're having police officers taken off the street to deal with this low-level offense. And then you're having young people sometimes who are put in jail, and then they have difficulties when they come out, right? So there's a lot of implications for these policies, and as legislators, we've got to look at how we are being mindful of taxpayer dollars, of how we're effectively investing those monies in a way that is going to produce tangible results. And so, you know, I've been really a strong ally with the Drug Policy Alliance in looking at really closing the loopholes in the state law. You know, New York State did decriminalize the possession of up to, 25 grams of marijuana. And the only way that you can get arrested is if it's in public view or being smoked. And what officers here in New York City have been doing is that in the process of a stop and frisk, for instance, if they do stop a young person and the person has a joint in their pocket and they happen to take it out in the process of that arrest, now that it's in public view, they're arresting that young person, right? And that's not the way the law was written. That's not the intent of the law. So the idea of closing the loophole is something that we're fighting at the state level, where we have a Republican Senate that refuses, I'm sorry, a Republicans in the Senate that are refusing to support this, you know, closing of the loophole. So there's work that we need to do with our allies and with all of you in terms of really making the message and taking the message to legislators. But I really want to commend the work that many of you are doing and for this film. I think it really brings it home. And for myself, that represents a constituency that deals with this issue each and every day, I just see how unjust it is, how ineffective it is, and that we have a long way to go, but that we need to continue to fight the good fight.
I'm John Tierney, and I want to really salute Paul and David for the film. It's just, it is really heartwarming to see it. I've been writing about this for a long time, and I know some of the people in the movie, you know, Ethan and Bradley Balco, and, you know, they've just been doing amazing work, and it's so frustrating when you cover this for a while and see how great the arguments are, how terrible the stories are, and things don't change. You know, watching the a story about Robert Moss reminded me last year for the New York Times. I did a series about incarceration, and I did one article about people serving mandatory life sentences with no parole for drugs. And they were just awful stories. The people were nonviolent. They, you know, some of them had been, you know, there was a Grateful Deadhead who was caught with some LSD that they trumped up the weight. They counted the paper that the blotter was on and sent him to prison for life. There's a woman whose boyfriend had stored some drugs in her house without her knowledge, and you know, he got out in a few years, as did everyone else, but she's serving life without parole. And there were about five stories like this I wrote about, and they were all terrible stories, and these were cases where the judges were saying, in fact, in all the cases, the judges have said, this is a terrible injustice, I don't want to do this, please, I hope someone undoes this. And in some of the cases, the prosecutors were saying, look, I have to do this, but please, I hope when their appeal comes up, someone should do something about this. And after I did the series, I heard from the lawyers, I've been talking to them, and there was a lot of hope that around Christmas time, or for the new year, they were hearing rumors that the White House had been asking for the files of these people, and that after all this publicity in the Times, something would happen. And so New Year's comes and nothing happens at all. And that is really, I mean, to me, it's really appalling to see this as a bipartisan failure. I mean, I've debated this with people on both sides of the aisle, with Bill Kristol, why is the Weekly Standard, you know, railing against drugs? I've debated it with prosecutors in cases I've done with Bush's drug czar. And it amazes me that, you know, that people, intelligent people, can look at this failed war and see the cost and all these things and still keep supporting it. And I'm not completely hopeless, and this kind of movie makes me feel, you know, more hopeful about it. As to why this goes on, you know, from covering it for a while, I just think it is an amazing example of how corrupting government is and how corrupting federal power is, because as Paul makes so clear in the movie, these things wouldn't be done, these SWAT teams wouldn't be breaking down houses if people actually had to pay for this in their own neighborhood. But at the federal level, it just becomes this issue of money that's being able to be dispensed, it's power that's being given, and no one's really accountable for it. And it's something, you know, that you see on both sides. Republicans love to moralize about it. Democrats, you know, they're not so moral about this, and Obama, of course, is himself a user. I've wondered why don't liberals take this more seriously, and I sometimes think it's really because they may like drugs or they may hate drug laws, but they love big government even more. And you see these very unholy alliances on Republicans and Democrats with prison guard unions, with police forces that are all profiting from this war, and that simply nobody really wants to stand up and take the money away. What I find hopeful, though, is seeing a movie like this, seeing what Reason does for this, and seeing, you know, the Army of David, as Glenn Reynolds calls it, the public sentiment against drugs is very strong, but it's never really had a voice because the establishment at both the local and the federal level, you know, there's a lot of money in it for people there. But, you know, people who see this effect on their families and their communities are not in favor of it. It was striking, I think, when the White House had a website where they were asking people what question to ask the president, that the marijuana question would just come to the top all the time. And of course, nobody in Washington, the Washington Press Corps is really too sophisticated to care about that anymore. It's, you know, they know that's kind of a, it's sort of one of these strange libertarian issues. But people really do care about it. And I think with the rise of the Tea Party, with Rand Paul, you know, coming out against mandatory minimums, I think there's a chance that there can be, you know, that the grassroots can be heard on this. And I hope Rand Paul will make this an issue. I'm not sure, you know, he's how strong he is on drugs. I know he's trying to play to the conservative base. But I think that, you know, the more we have the web, thanks to the web, we have more of a chance for people to actually rally around this issue and to make some headway against these established forces that are doing it. And finally, there is some hope, I think, at the state level that they simply can't afford to incarcerate all these people anymore. And so you are seeing on both sides of the aisle, and some Republican governors have led the way in this, realizing we just can't afford to keep building prisons to lock these people up. So I'm hoping that between popular organization, this Army of David that has a way to reach each other, and between fiscal realities, that something can happen. But in the meantime, I think this movie is just an amazing achievement. It's maddening, it's heartwarming at the same time, and congratulations.
Thanks, John.
Yeah, just to second that, Paul, really excellent film, and congratulations to you and David Knott and Reason Foundation for putting the resources behind this and putting this out there. I think what might be most helpful, because you already heard me up there, you know, decrying how terrible this drug war is, how long it's been going on, America's massive incarceration policy, the incredibly destructive role around the world, not just in Mexico and the Caribbean, Latin America, but now in West Africa and a whole range of other parts of the world. So enough with that. I mean, enough, because you heard it. But I thought what might be most helpful is just, you know, things are moving in a more positive direction on drug policy reform and criminal justice reform right now than at any time in all the years I've been involved in this. And you know, it's still this massive, you know, ocean liner of a drug war, prison industrial complex moving forward, and it's with all this momentum behind it, but things are changing. And I just want to pick out a few things. You heard me say Obama was such a terrible disappointment in the second half of his first term. But I'll say this. Those guys kept telling us, this is a second term issue if we get a chance. In the last 5-6 weeks, they've been to some extent making good on that. You got Holder standing up 5-6 weeks ago and announcing the Bar Association that this issue of over-incarceration is a moral issue and a fiscal issue in America and a public safety issue. Then following up last week, Congressional Black Caucus, and actually pushing the envelope on trying to reduce federal incarceration as much as possible, given the constraints of federal law, judicial prerogative, and the relative independence of U.S. attorneys. They seem to care about this. Holder was telling people in his first term he wanted this to be a legacy issue for him, reducing incarceration, and we kept going, where's the legacy? Thanks for the crack powder reform, but where's the rest of it? It looks like something is now beginning to happen on that front. The fact that he was able to justify this policy by pointing not just to Democratic but Republican governors around the country, from Christie in New Jersey to former Mitch Daniels in Indiana to Nathan Deal in Georgia and a whole range of others who are also beginning to reduce incarceration for fiscal reasons, for moral reasons, for other reasons, also shows that we're beginning to see a turn here. Now, as I said before, it's a bit like turning around an ocean liner. You can start to point in a new direction, but it takes a long time before it really begins to turn. But remember, last year was, I think, the first, well, 2 years ago was the first year we actually saw a reduction in overall incarceration in America. Last year, we saw half the states reduce their incarceration at least a little bit. So there's a lot of bad stuff still going on, but it's happening. And then, of course, there's the marijuana issue. Look at that Gallup poll that they put up there where you see 50% of the country now saying make it legal. I can tell you there's private and public polling ranging from Maine and New Jersey to New Mexico to Hawaii to Oregon, even Louisiana, now showing majorities of the population in favor of legalizing marijuana. You're seeing close to over 55, close to 60% in some places. It seems to me that public support in America has jumped 5 or 10 points just in the last year because the victories in Washington and Colorado made it feel real. Well, you know, I was wondering what the Obama administration was going to do. I thought they'd come out with something sort of a yellow light like they did with medical marijuana a few years ago. But that light was a lot more greenish than I expected a few weeks ago. They basically said to Washington, Colorado, we're going to give you a chance to implement these new laws. Here's our 8 criteria. You try to meet those criteria. And I think they were saying that in good faith. 4 years ago it was, Obama said during the campaign he's not going to have to medical marijuana. What's the least we can give in order to accommodate that? Now I think it was a lot more real on this front. So we're seeing a shift there. And I'll tell you, keep your eye on Oregon next year, maybe Alaska next year for legalizing marijuana more broadly. Then look at California and Maine and look at Nevada. Look at a whole range of other places, maybe Massachusetts, maybe some states in the South because the numbers are jumping there quickly. So we're seeing a real shift. When I would travel outside the United States, I would typically find myself apologizing as an American for the horrific consequences of our U.S.-led global war on drugs. But now I feel there's at least one respect in which I can hold my head high. Because who's leading the world now when it comes to marijuana law reform? It's the United States of America. Not at the federal level, but at the levels of public opinion, civil society, and state government. 20 states that have legalized medical marijuana, a couple million people with legal marijuana IDs, over 1,000, maybe 2,000 dispensaries around the country. Washington and Colorado have legalized, and now the Justice Department giving a little room to run. We are leading the world in that regard. But it's not just us. Yesterday, I had the good fortune to have a meeting with President Mujica, the head of Uruguay, who's in New York for the UN meetings. And it looks like Uruguay could become the first country to legalize marijuana in the next month or so, right? Then you look at Europe. The Dutch seemed like they were pulling back on their cannabis policy. Now, in fact, they're saying, let's try to figure out a way to legalize the whole thing. And you see the Czechs, and you see the Spanish, and you see a range of other Europeans, the Swiss, trying to find other ways to legally regulate this stuff, almost saying, weren't we Europeans at the lead of sensible drug policy? Now America's leading there and Latin American there. And that list of former presidents, Cardoso, Gaviria, and Zedillo from Brazil, Colombia, and Mexico, now it's not just former presidents. Now you got current President Mujica in Uruguay, you got Otto Perez Molina from Guatemala, you got Santos from Colombia, all calling into question the basic prohibitionist paradigm. We're seeing a challenge beginning to bubble up. There are people, presidents, giving speeches at the UN this week saying we need to move in a new direction. So I don't want to say the whole House of Cards is coming tumbling down, but I can tell you from high levels to the national security agencies who want to now talk to people like me for the first time in decades, to people involved with the anti-drug campaigns who are saying, wait a second, the world's changing. We need to hear from you. How do we deal with these issues? Something's really happening. I've always been very cautious about saying we're at a tipping point. You know, because you can only say that so many times, right? But this is the year I'm saying that when it comes to marijuana policy, I think we've hit a tipping point. The last point I'm going to say, this has been crucial to who Drug Policy Alliance is and this growing movement. We fight for two things. One is to reduce the harms the government does with its drug war, the incarceration and violence and wasted money and destruction of lives and spread of disease and all that. And the other thing we do is to try to reduce the harms that people do to themselves with drugs. That meant legalizing needle exchange programs in the early years. Now it means 911, Good Samaritan laws, and getting the antidote and naloxone out there so that we don't have so many people dying from overdoses. That's got to be the focus. The best drug policy we can have is one that reduces the harms of drugs and that reduces the harms of the government's drug control policies. We are turning a corner, whether it's the ocean liner on massive incarceration or the tipping point on marijuana. But I don't want to leave us all here depressed. We actually are beginning to make some real progress.
Well, please join me in thanking all our panelists tonight.